I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. Before we get to our agenda, I'll go through the safety message here. Everyone here today must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. Please leave all signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. All the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present to help maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. And members, we have 7 bills on the agenda. Thank you to everybody who submitted letters and written testimony. Committee materials, as always, are posted online, and there are some copies out front for the public. And with that, the first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Berg, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 4th, 2026?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Berg moves approval of the minutes for March 4th, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes, the motion prevails. The minutes for March 4th, 2026 are approved. The first bill on today's agenda is House File 3465. This is Representative Liebling's bill that we didn't get to last week, so apologies and thank you for being back here today, Chair Liebling. Because you're not on the committee, I will move to lay over House File 3465. Your bill is before us. There are no amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee, for hearing this bill today. This bill came from a constituent. The story is that his partner had dementia but was living in her own home, and her adult son visited her. And while in her home, he accessed her bank account through her phone and stole about $46,000 from her. Initially, when this was charged, he spoke to the county attorney in Olmsted County, where I am from, and was initially told that this would be charged as financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. But then later found out that it wasn't charged that way because it really didn't meet the elements of that crime, which requires some kind of a fiduciary duty to the person, to the vulnerable adult. So this case was charged as a theft, and the constituent was really upset by that because the charging document did not reflect the egregiousness of the son taking advantage of his mother's vulnerability. So, as I said, under the financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult statute, you have to prove there's a fiduciary obligation to the victim, and the son here had no such fiduciary obligation, but of course he knew his mother was vulnerable. Even when that element is present, the same penalties apply under the theft statute. So in my understanding, there's very little incentive for a prosecutor to charge under 609.2335. And that may mean also that the conviction data that we have underrepresents the charged cases where the victim of a theft is a vulnerable adult. So this legislation attempts to give prosecutors another option, one that reflects the egregiousness of the offense while keeping the current statutory scheme. It increases the available penalty when the actor knows that the victim is a vulnerable adult. So I'd like to thank the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and Judge Small is here with me just to answer questions. And do you still go by Judge? I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Okay. of course, I think committee members here know he is from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. He gave me a lot of assistance in coming up with this approach, and also I'd like to thank my local county attorney, Mike Walters, who also reviewed this with his staff and had no concerns about it. And that's pretty much it, members. So happy to take questions.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Any questions for Chair Liebling? Or for Judge Small. Representative Curran.
Just really quick, so having worked in the field of people with developmental disabilities, I'm used to this only applying basically to people who work with folks. And for some narrative here, it's a disqualifier then. If somebody has committed a VA, they're not able to perform that job anymore. So I'm glad that we're adding this in so that people even trying to get jobs with vulnerable people, if they have stolen from them in the past, won't be able to get that job. I think I appreciate that. Thank you.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just noting, as I did on a, we had a bill a couple sessions ago that also increased penalties, and just to note that I think this makes a lot of sense as a recognition of being a more serious offense if a theft is done against a vulnerable adult, that it's, and it's not the case that that this would necessarily be a deterrence, for example, which is sometimes a justification for increased penalties. I don't know if somebody's going to look up the statute books to find out, but more just reflecting that we want to make sure that our penalties are reflecting how seriously we as a society just feel about an offense. And this feels like it adjusts our statutes to better reflect that. And so it seems like an improvement to me. And thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Judge Small. Thank you.
Great. Any further member comments? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I actually have a question for Representative Liebling. Would this also apply to the just absolutely prevalent, disgusting scams that's going on of elderly people that we see now? They're doing bitcoins and all these things.
Chair Liebling.
So, Madam Chair, thanks for the question. I think that was Chair Novotny. I couldn't really see, but I think it was. So I think it would, because if it's a theft and fits under the theft statute, which I think often these things would, I think the person would have to know that the victim is a vulnerable adult. So, that might be a proof question, but I think it could apply in some of those instances, yes.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Representative Liebling and Chair Mueller. I would just, it's a good bill, and we've been involved in these investigations and just see how horrible it is, how these life savings can be just ripped out. And I appreciate that it's going to a felony from the standpoint that this might make it easier to prosecute for the funds that go offshore. So I appreciate that. And with that, Chair Mueller, I'm done.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Representative Liebling?
Thank you all for listening to the bill, and I do think this is one of those things that I want to appreciate that I think Representative Rapinski signed on as an author. Appreciate that, and this should be a bipartisan bill and reflects the concern that we all have and that we're all seeing as reflected in the question there about what's happening with vulnerable adults. So thank you, members.
Thank you for bringing the bill to us. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 3465. We're going to have Vice Chair Feist take the gavel now. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3782. This is Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move to re-refer House File 3782 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my motion.
Great. Chair Mueller, your bill is before us. You do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to present it in?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Okay, before we take action on the DE2, we do have an oral amendment. Fancy. Mr. Johnson, can you please state the oral amendment?
Madam Chair and members, the substance of the oral amendment is to change the word distraction to diversionary in four places. On page 1, lines 9 and 19, delete distraction and insert diversionary. And then on page 2, lines 2 and 4, delete distraction and insert diversionary.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Next, we will move to the DE2 amendment as amended. Any discussion to the amendment? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you. Thank you for that, going through that procedural hurdle there. Well done, Madam Chair. So, members, this bill as amended is a result of some information shared with me by Colin Hortman after the horrible events of this summer. I'm not going to speak for a long time about this. He is here to testify virtually today. But as you'll hear, there are substantial safety concerns related to the deployment of chemical irritants inside buildings and the need to properly remediate those. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will go ahead and defer to my testifier, and then I can follow up with some additional comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will now turn to our testifier. And before you begin, please unmute yourself. Please state your name and proceed. Thank you.
Colin Hortman. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you perfectly. Thank you.
All right, great. Hello, everyone. I'm Colin Hortman, Mark and Melissa Hortman's son. I was asked to speak about the cleanup process my family faced after tear gas and other chemical irritants were deployed at my parents' home, the house I grew up in. After my parents were murdered, law enforcement fired multiple tear gas canisters into the home because they believed the perpetrator might still be inside. I was never given an exact number of devices used, but I know there was at least a dozen, with one being deployed in every room, sometimes more. The deployment caused obvious physical damage to the house, but the more serious problem was the chemical residue left behind throughout the entire home. We were told the effects would only last a few days, but that was not our experience. When I went back into the house during the first week to collect some sentimental items, the residue was still everywhere. My eyes started stinging, my throat burned, and my skin became irritated just from being inside and moving things around. Every step on the carpet kicked powder into the air, and at the time I didn't realize the residue could still be that hazardous, or protective equipment should be worn when entering a space that had been exposed to tear gas. Because of the amount of residue, we were not truly able to enter the home safely for months. The remediation was not completed until nearly 8 months later. During that time, the house could not be lived in, could not be sold, and could not be fully accessed without risking exposure to whatever chemicals had been used inside. One of the challenges we faced was confirming exactly what had been deployed. The remediation contractors had experience with these situations, but they still needed to know what chemicals were used and how much in order to determine the proper cleanup procedure. We did not have that information at first. We had to request that from the city, and the records were not very clear. We were sent safety data sheets for several agents that could have been used, and that information helped guide the testing. And we also did not initially understand who was responsible for paying for the remediation. Our homeowner's insurance was denied coverage because of the residue was considered a pollutant. We later learned under Minnesota law that the agency that deploys tear gas is responsible for the cleanup, but figuring that out was not straightforward. Even after that, the process took time and a lot of coordination. If it was not for the attorneys who were already helping our family in the criminal case and were willing to give their additional time to help us navigate this problem, I would have had to do much more on my own. I reached out to people in state government, contractors, and others who had experience with this kind of cleanup just to understand what the right process was supposed to be. Even with that help, I spent weeks making calls, tracking people down, and trying to connect to the city, the contractors, and the professionals who were working to make the home safe. The delay was not just frustrating, it was emotional. This is my childhood home. After my parents died, one of the things I wanted to do was sit at the table, have the last drink they had, eat the last dessert they made the night before they died. Because of the delays in getting the house cleaned safely, that still has not happened. At times, the slow communication made it feel like the process was being dragged out, even if that wasn't the intent. My family was in a position where we could wait for the cleanup to be done correctly. Many people are not. When tear gas is used in someone's home, they may still be living there. They might need to sell the house, or they may need it cleaned quickly so their life can move forward. Without clear information about what chemicals were used and without a clear process for cleanup, families can feel pressured to accept whatever solution is offered first, even if hazardous residue might still be left behind. I'm here because I want to help future victims have a clearer path than we did. Homeowners should be told what chemical agents were used, how much was used, and should be given the safety data sheets right away so the proper testing and cleanup can begin without delay. Clear documentation and clear communication would make this process faster, safer, and less traumatic for people who are already going through one of the worst experiences of their lives. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you so much, Colin, and we're so deeply sorry for your loss. And thank you for sharing your experience with us so that we can work to address it for people who have this experience in the future.
Absolutely.
Hopefully
thank
not.
You.
Thank you. And with that, I will look at my notes to figure out. Chair Mueller, comments?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And also, again, want to give my heartfelt thanks to Colin for his work on this bill. And in true Hortman fashion, he's doing this to help other people. So, just to kind of walk through the bill quickly, it gives building owners and occupants, of course, may not know what irritants are used or even that they need remediation. So this would require law enforcement using chemical irritants inside a building to just provide a standardized notice that we've asked DPS to provide, just to leave some information behind for the owner or occupant that they may need to have remediation and that they can reach out to the local law enforcement agency that deployed the irritants to find out exactly, to his point, what was used and how much was used. And then to deal with the insurance issues, there's a separate bill in the Commerce Committee, so this committee doesn't need to deal with those issues. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Chair Mueller. We will now move to member discussion. Are there any members? Representative Steer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that last point, you said how much was used, and I'm trying to find out where in the bill it says we have to, maybe I missed it.
Chair Mueller?
Thank you. Yes, in the DE2, let's see here, I've got to find the right line. Somebody, I hear other people saying it here.
It looks like Mr. Johnson might have an answer.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, if you look at page 2, line 3, that paragraph D lists the things that have to be disclosed. It includes the name, the product number, the total number of all chemical irritants, smoke screens, and diversionary devices deployed.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Steer, did you have any follow-up questions?
I do. Just on another one, I do like this bill a lot. I'm just trying to figure out the logistics of it. With like a SWAT team that goes in, you have multiple agencies going in. Is it a SWAT team leaves one piece of form, or does each person that each department have to leave it there? Where do we go from that?
Chair Mueller.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. The idea is just to leave a notice behind so that somebody living there knows that they have the right. So I would imagine in that situation, whoever's in command of the scene would be the agency responsible for leaving the notice behind.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to briefly echo the sentiment that you expressed that I'm sure is shared by all of us, that this is a remarkable example of exactly what Melissa Hortman would have done in terms of taking a tragedy and then doing something about it, not to remediate what happened to them, but to ensure that going forward, people don't have to go through a similar process, and that doesn't go without notice. Thank you.
Any other members would like to comment? Seeing no. Oh, I'm so sorry, Representative Co-Chair Nabotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Chair Mueller, thanks for bringing it forward. As I said, it's an opportunity. I'd like to work with you with a couple of suggestions to improve the form before it goes out. And with that, I recommend a yes vote.
Okay. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
No, just thank you so much for your consideration and glad to work on any amendments that that you see fit. Thank you.
Thank you, members, for the discussion. Chair Mueller renews the motion to re-refer House File 3782 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? None. The motion prevails. We will now take up the next two bills, House File 4075 and House File 391 together. Chair Mueller will present House File 4075, and Chair Scott will present House File 391. Once we hear from the bill authors and have discussion, it is our intention to take action on each bill. Welcome to the committee, Chair Scott. We will start with House File 391. Chair Scott, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Chair Mueller for working on this issue with me. In 2015, the legislature worked diligently on a bill to get firearms out of the hands of domestic abusers via court orders to transfer any firearms the abuser possesses to a federally licensed firearm dealer, a law enforcement officer, or a qualified third party. This bill was a compromise with the folks that are advocates for those that have experienced domestic violence, prosecutors, Second Amendment advocates, and so forth. And a few short years later, in fact, 2018, and you should have this in your packet, Carrie Levin did a three-part story. A.J. Legault was the reporter, and found that not only had a woman in Aurora been murdered because the hearing, there was never a follow-up hearing to make sure that those firearms were turned over, but we found out that in most cases, there wasn't a single county that was really having much of a follow-up except up in Roseau. So, and that judge was really on top of it there. If you haven't, I encourage you to go watch the video or read the story that's in your packet. It is quite remarkable. And just some of the data that they read off in there, our analysis revealed that there were 598 cases in Hennepin County, Minnesota's largest. Firearm transfer affidavits were filed just 11 times, less than 2% of the time. There were 2,937 OFP cases statewide automatically requiring gun transfers. Only 119 of them had a firearm transfer affidavit with the court. That means that 96% of the time, there's no record the abusers gave up the firearms. So what this bill does is it creates a follow-up compliance hearing so that we can make sure that those firearms are turned over and an affidavit is filed with the courts. There is also language in there that says if the abuser, or in this case we're changing the name to the subject, that they can be arrested if they don't show up for that compliance hearing and be found in contempt as well. There's further information on that in 9.7 through 9.15. Subdivision 5 and 6 deal with Fifth Amendment issues that could arise. And this language was taken from a case out of the state of Washington that dealt with this very kind of compliance hearing where someone was being compelled to turn over their firearms. So that's basically what the bill does. It's a follow-up hearing to make sure that those firearms are taken out of hands of abusers and people that could use them to harm others.
Thank you so much, Chair Scott. Chair Mueller, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, thank you so much to Chair Scott, who for years has been raising this issue of removing guns from abusers. And here we are together presenting a gun bill, really, and really with the goal of making sure that the people who should not have firearms don't have them. And as she said, implementation has just not happened, even though it is written into the law already. And after the Burnsville shooting in 2024, we created a task force on domestic violence and firearm surrender. The task force made a number of recommendations for all branches of government, and I'll just note, it is online, available online, the report. I highly recommend looking at it. As task forces do, made a lot of recommendations, and so we tried to take what we could, what was practical for this year, not every single thing in the bill, and put it into the version of the bill that I have here. According to that report, research indicates that perpetrators of domestic violence often have a documented history of violence, and Violence Free Minnesota does try to track this, and approximately 50 to 60% of their intimate partner homicides have a documented history of violence, and almost a quarter of the women who are survivors report that their partners have illegal access to firearms. Research indicates that firearm possession prohibitions are most effective at preventing intimate partner violence when they include relinquishment provisions and clear instructions to the courts, law enforcement, petitioners, and offenders. The report made numerous recommendations that include the compliance hearing, but also many other recommendations. And I think I'll just give maybe a high-level overview of how our bill differs. And I'll just say that we are very committed to working together to get one bill in a final form as this continues to move through the process. But just so the committee and the public's aware of how they differ, again, a high-level overview. So when CHIPS or OFP petitions are filed, this bill would require that the petitioner provide, to the best of their knowledge, any firearms possessed by the abusing party. It also says that when firearms are prohibited under current laws, that the subject must surrender their permit to purchase and permit to carry. It eliminates loopholes in some of our current laws where a defendant is only prohibited from possessing pistols or, in some situations, only the firearm that was used for the commission of that offense. And this is a recommendation of the report, was to prohibit all firearms in that situation. And then it describes the process for the defendant, court, and law enforcement to follow related to surrendering their firearm. It does provide for transfer to a federally licensed dealer or to the subject's local law enforcement agency within 24 hours. The current law says 3 days, and the current law does have a third-party transfer, which I know is something that we'll be discussing as this moves forward. This bill also describes what law enforcement and the federal dealer can do with the firearms received. It requires the subject to file the proof of transfer with the court or the declaration in the compliance hearing, which is where our bills align, and then provides for a search warrant to law enforcement if the firearms are not surrendered. I will thank the sheriffs and the County Attorneys Association for their feedback, much of which we tried to incorporate in the amendment to my bill, which I know we haven't moved yet, but just so you all know where that comes from. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Mueller. We do have one member of the public who has signed up to testify, Chief Potts. Would you like to make your way to the testifier table? You'll have 2 minutes, and you can introduce yourself and your title for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Jeff Potts. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'm here representing them, roughly 300 police chiefs and a few hundred command staff members. I'll make my comments quick. We very much appreciate you allowing us to come in here and just share some comments, real quick comments. In general, we support this initiative. You know, we know that for a long time these guns have not been surrendered, and this is a solid effort to try to fix that. Chair Mueller referenced that task force report that's available online. We just want to highlight that a lot of the recommendations came kind of caveated on if you're going to do X, which is force the surrender of the firearms, which we agree with, that there should also be some funding made available to law enforcement to help secure those, store those. We learned through ERPO that's a costly endeavor. And I'll reference page 29, paragraph that starts with recommendations. Legislators should establish a statewide firearm surrender fund to reimburse law enforcement on a per gun, per year basis, remove liability for firearm damage, and all legal mechanisms used to order surrender, and remove the requirement for law enforcement to pay for the firearms. That goes on, but that piece right there is really what we are concerned about with this bill. This is a major departure. There's roughly 21, according to the BCA's crime report for 2024, there's 21,687 victims of domestic violence in 2024. We know that a significant percentage of the perpetrators own firearms, in some cases large amounts of firearms. And so we just want to continue to work with the author, hopefully provide for some funding so agencies can do this. As with ERPO, there's a fairly well-established process to dispossess firearms from people. That can be very dangerous. And the bill's quite light on how that's done. Now, we agreed it should be done, but just know that when you're talking tens of thousands potentially of firearms, that dispossession process and your law enforcement is put in the position to take those firearms, it needs to be done with thought. And, of course, our goal is always voluntary dispossession of the firearms. But we do have concerns about the cost of storing those firearms moving forward pursuant to the new law. Again, thank you for our ability to testify here today and put these concerns on the record.
Right. Thank you, Chief Potts. Chair Mueller, did you want to respond?
Yeah, thank you so much. I certainly appreciate that. I will just note that under current law, that is the practice. There's the opportunity for third-party transfer, law enforcement, or through an FFL. So this does eliminate the third party in this bill. But again, I'm totally willing to work on that, as I indicated to Chair Scott.
And I'll also just point out, too, under the bill, they are allowed to charge a storage fee. And then we added some clarity in our amendment that says if they don't pay it within 30 days, they're basically considered to have forfeited the right to storage. And so we also added in, if somebody has a lifetime prohibition, that they don't have to be stored forever, that they can be destroyed. So we tried to build in some things that made it clear that the agencies weren't going to have to store thousands and thousands of guns into perpetuity. There were some ways to avoid that. But I certainly appreciate those concerns and glad to continue working on it.
Thank you. We did not have anyone else from the public sign up to testify. So now we will move on to member discussion of House Files 4075 and 391. Oh, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Chairs Mueller and Scott for working on this. I don't know that anybody's brought up the article in our packet from CARE 11 from 2018, but like this has been a longstanding mess. Maybe you did, Chair Scott. You did. I'm sorry. I must have spaced at that moment. My apologies. Well, it's good to point people to it again, though, because this has been a massive problem for years. And I'm recalling, Chair Mueller, like we had a series, probably like every couple months, we would have these series of meetings for years trying to figure out what to do about this. Chair Scott, I know you were leading on this as well. And then eventually decided, I was happy to be the author of the bill to create the task force, and then you, Chair Mueller, working with Ms. McDaniel and others, were then tracking that. And sometimes we put together a task force and, you know, kind of not quite sure what you're going to get. This has been, these are some really effective recommendations, and then to have you turn them into these bills is really grateful to you, because this has been a major problem for years, and I'm so glad that we're making progress on it now. So thank you to both of you. Thank you, Chair.
Any other members wishing to comment? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Mueller. So my question, again, just kind of follows on what the Executive Director said. It'd be the local impact to police departments and sheriff's departments like ERPO. I know there was grants available for gun safes. We did see an increase in, or law enforcement saw an increase in guns and then storing the guns if they don't choose another path. So my question would be, like a local impact note. I don't know if that's a possibility on this, or we could see, you know, what the cost is going to be to the counties and the cities, and maybe set up a grant or some way for funding.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the question. You know, as our fiscal notes go, we just say it will have an impact locally, but we never account for that. And that's true when we create new crimes, when we increase penalties. I mean, there are many situations that this committee does things that do have a local impact. I think that in itself is a separate discussion that I will be gone next year, but I think it'd be a good discussion for those remaining to have. But that said, I'm certainly open to looking into some sort of grant or some other process for storage here.
Thank you. Thanks.
Any other member discussion? Looks like we'll go to your Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Chair Mueller, thank you for bringing this forward. This is something that's concerned me for a long time. When this bill was initially put into law, I was the supervisor of the, I supervised the evidence room at where I worked, and it originally had a lot of firearms being turned over to us, and then we strongly encouraged them, the judges, to start directing them to third-party transfers because we just did not have the ability to store that and take on the responsibility for that. I want to make it clear to the public that's out there that these orders are just not being issued. Initially, when the law changed, the judges were complying and they were issuing the orders. I want to make it clear that it's not law enforcement following up on this. It's that the orders aren't being issued to start with. So whatever it takes to get the judges to actually follow the law that people that probably sat in this room ordered, I am for that. And, you know, there's been some cases where some orders weren't exactly issued and are issued correctly. And then we found out, like, the incident that took place at the Buffalo Alina Clinic was a result of that. So I think we need to make sure that the courts are issuing the orders correctly and that they're, you know, law enforcement will follow up with if, but as, you know, confirmed by what Executive Director Potts said, that third-party transfer is. I would encourage you to keep that in the bill, just from the standpoint of the time and the money that would be responsible for a local law enforcement agency to comply with this. So it's always an option if there's not any other option, but the first point should be that third-party transfer or something like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like we don't have any more member discussion. Any final comments from our authors? Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just on that third-party transfer issue, for those of you that weren't around when this took place, the existing language is that that third party has to be a qualified party. It can't just be somebody, the brother that may not be qualified to have a firearm himself, okay? It's someone that has to be qualified to have a firearm. And if they allow the offender to get access to the firearms, it's a gross misdemeanor. So that's up to a year in prison, so in jail. So it's not a slap on the hands for that. That was part of the grand compromise when the bill was established, was that third party piece. And I do have concerns for the safety of law enforcement going forward too, if if they're having to go get these firearms, and I mean, if somebody knows they're coming, right? You know, it's a little bit of a concern there. So I think that's just more stuff that we can work through to make sure that our law enforcement is safe. And if we need to talk to the sheriffs or the police folks for an idea of what their storage costs are now, we can probably get a fairly good idea of what it's going to cost them going forward. But those are my final comments. And I appreciate the members' questions, and I would love to see this become law so that we can get these firearms out of the arms of dangerous people.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Mueller, any final comments?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Novotny, to your point too, the task force does make a number of recommendations for all branches of government. And so I'm really glad we can take one little piece of those, not even little, it's pretty significant piece of those recommendations and do our job, and certainly hope that the other branches of government take a look at that report and make changes. The bill that I have next to creating the Domestic Violence Task Force, this is certainly something that we could, put into that task force as well to make sure that they're actually doing the things that the law says in this regard. So thank you for your consideration. And again, thanks to Chair Scott for all her work on this bill over the years.
Okay. Thank you, chairs. And thank you, members, for the discussion. We are now going to move on to action, or we're going to act on each bill. We will first act on House File 4075. Chair Mueller, would you like to move to re-refer House File 4075 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
That is my motion.
Chair Mueller, your bill is before us. We do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, that is my motion.
Great. Any discussion to the amendment? Those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. I always forget when I'm supposed to use the gavel, so I do it very timidly. Anyway, it's adopted. Is there any other further discussion to House File 4075 as amended? And we've already done closing comments, unless you have more to say. No? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Vice Chair Witte.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. Sorry for the late question. I think, Representative Scott, you brought something up. There's a 12-hour deadline for law enforcement to execute a search warrant. Obviously, this can be, bringing out SWAT teams or other things for this. 12 hours might not be, if you don't get it done within 12 hours, bringing people in. Is that something that can be, obviously, calling in team members can take a little bit of time, if that helps out at all. Just that 12 hours might be a little too quick.
Representative Woody, I think that's in Chair Mueller's bill.
Chair Mueller?
The 12-hour warrant.
Yeah, thank you. I don't believe there is a 12-hour requirement for the warrant, and I would ask Mr. Diebel if he could address
Mr.
Diebel?
Oh, okay.
As far as executing the warrant.
Okay.
There's an issuance and an exit. Right.
Sorry, I misread that.
It's okay.
I'm so sorry. I thought you weren't ready. Oh, so we've established that is not a, there is no 12-hour. Okay. Sorry, everyone's just looking at me.
You're just keeping us on our toes. Sorry.
Okay. That's good. Great. Any further comments by the committee? Okay. Members, thank you for the discussion. Chair Mueller renews the motion to re-refer House File 4075 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. And now we will move to House File 391. Chair Scott, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move to re-refer House File 391 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Chair Scott, your bill is before us. You do have an author's amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And the DE1 amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion to House File 391? Chair Scott, oh, I'm so sorry, Representative Hudson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm not saying I'm confused, but just for the sake of anybody who might be watching and is confused about what to expect going forward, so both these bills are moving to Judiciary. Could you just kind of walk us through what the plan is going forward?
Yeah, we're going to arm wrestle for...
You'll win.
No, probably not. TBD.
TBD.
Yeah. Chair Mueller. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. I really hope that we can work together to meld our bills. I absolutely understand that some of the concerns that she's brought forward. I actually have some ideas around the third-party transfer and perhaps some guardrails to put around that. So I'm really optimistic that we can get this into one bill that everybody can support. Thank you.
Thanks. Great. Any closing comments? Good. Okay. Members, thank you for the discussion. I will renew the motion to re-refer House File 391 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm complicated. What? Yeah. Oh, I know. Okay. Ready. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3946. This is also Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move to re-refer House File 3946 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Great. Chair Mueller, your bill is before us. You do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Great. Any discussion to the amendment?
I can just give a quick, if I can, Madam Chair, just so members know, the amendment eliminates Section 2 of the bill that's based on stakeholder feedback from Violence Free Minnesota and Standpoint, and then the other aspects of the amendment also incorporate stakeholder feedback.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Those in favor of this amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So during the interim, I had planned to devote most of my time in the interim working on bills related to domestic violence. Obviously, the interim did not happen as expected. However, I was still able to talk to multiple victims, advocates, and other stakeholders. Also, I read a number of reports and news stories about cases falling through the cracks and looked at some of the domestic violence laws in Wisconsin, and we don't want to let Wisconsin be better than we are when it comes to this issue, or any issue for that matter. And then finally, I drew on some troubling things that I observed as a prosecutor in recent years, which was consistent with observations of other stakeholders. House File 3946 is a result of that work, and I'll just do a high-level overview of each of the sections of the bill. The first section amends the reporting requirement for the BCA's Use of Force Investigation Unit to require information about incidents that began with a domestic abuse call. I had asked them for that data, and they said it's unavailable because it's not something that's currently reported or that they collect. Mm-hmm. There have obviously been some high-profile incidents involving use of force in response to domestic calls, so I thought this would be good information for us to have. Section 3 of the bill amends the definition of domestic abuse cases in the statute that requires prosecutors to have policies on how to handle these cases. It adds numerous offenses that appear to be inadvertently left out. It was something that I'm really grateful nonpartisan staff found for us.
And it just makes this statute consistent with other ones where the prosecutor has to provide notice to victims in those cases of a declination to prosecute. Section 4 requires law enforcement agencies to report to DPS on domestic violence incidents with additional information, and then DPS would summarize that in the final report. There really is a lack of data collection and information on these cases, and this reporting requirement in the bill is consistent with other statutory reporting requirements for law enforcement agencies. Section 5 is probably, I would say, one of the most important pieces of this bill. It removes the limitation that officers can only make arrests for non-felony domestic abuse cases within 72 hours. That was the thing I heard most frequently from survivors, from families, from other advocates, was that offenders know that there's the 72-hour rule, and so they'll be what's called gone on arrival, and they know that they can sort of hide out for that period of time and then hope that the case goes away. And research shows that suspects in these gone-on-arrival cases have a higher risk of reoffending and actually pose a higher lethality risk to victims. This is one of those areas where we decided to model after Wisconsin law. I'll also note that the amendment adds a new section based on advocate feedback. Where there's a loophole in the current law, victim and advocates are able to get police reports for misdemeanor domestic violence cases, but because it's not clearly laid out in statute, they're having trouble getting that information for felony cases. And so the amendment addresses that. And I am aware the chiefs had provided some even additional information. We may need to amend that statute even further to make sure the right people have access to those reports. Section 6, 7, and 10 is ensuring that somebody who is an offender is not released prior to going in front of a judge. And the importance for that is to make sure that the court can issue what's called a domestic abuse no contact order so that there's the opportunity for that DANCO to be issued before the offender gets released. And then the final sections 8 and 9 create a task force on improving the response to domestic violence cases. One thing I also heard consistently is that there really needs to be lethality assessments done in these cases. And so we've asked the task force to look at that and have a consistent lethality assessment across the state. And then there are a number of other suggestions, which I'm not going to go through. You can read those in the bill yourself. And I've given this to many, many stakeholders. I've not received any negative feedback. Thank you. And I do have a testifier.
Okay. Thank you so much, Chair Mueller. Your testifier can come up. And when you arrive at the front here, you can state your name and your title for the record, and you can proceed.
Okay. Oh, shoot. Back there. All right. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Jana Williams. I am an aunt. I'm a family member of a victim. So... good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the House. My name is Jana Williams, and I'm here today as an aunt who lost my niece to domestic violence. My niece, Allison Lusher, was beaten to death by someone she loved. Allison did everything that the system tells victims to do. She called 911 for help 7 different times. Not yet only once were charges were sent up. She filed for orders for protection, and yet they were never served. Under current law, if law enforcement cannot locate the perpetrator within 10 days and the OFP is never served, it never takes effect and it is null and void. But today, I'm here to talk about yet another law that also failed Allison, the 72-hour probable cause arrest statute in Minnesota, 629.34. Under the statute, law enforcement has a limited window to make a probable cause arrest after domestic violence. The clock begins immediately after the assault. It means that if officers cannot locate the suspect within the first 72 hours, excluding the first 24 hours, meaning if the attack happens at 11:45 p.m., the first 24 hours is up at 11:59 p.m., then that 72-hour clock starts at midnight for officers to make a probable cause arrest on a suspect. There is a serious problem with how this law is understood and applied. If you ask 100 officers across Minnesota what this statute means, you will likely get 100 different interpretations of this law. Some interpret the exclusion of the first 24 hours differently. Others believe they no longer have authority to arrest once that window has passed. That confusion creates inconsistency in enforcement, and victims pay the price. The gap that the law cost Allison her life. Let me tell you what happened. On Tuesday, February 13, 2024, at 6:30 p.m., Allison let her abuser into her apartment. He began brutally beating and choking her. He tore off all of her clothing, believing that if she was naked, she would be too ashamed to run for help. But Allison ran anyways. She ran naked through her apartment building to a neighbor's door to escape him. Her neighbor called 911 around 6:46 p.m. Officers arrived shortly afterwards, but the suspect was GOA, gone on arrival. The officers told Allison and her neighbor that if he comes back, call us. We'll come back and we'll arrest him. But you only have until midnight on Friday to do so because of that 72-hour state statute. These officers believed that they only had that limited time to arrest him. After that window had passed, the opportunity for the immediate probable cause arrest would be gone. Friday night, a little bit after midnight, Allison returned home, and she heard noises in her apartment. She knew it was her abuser. So afraid, she ran to another neighbor's apartment, where they called 911. The same two officers that had responded on Tuesday night came on Friday night. They knew she had been beaten, choked, and stripped of her clothing during the previous assault. But because it was after what they interpreted that 72-hour state statute, that window, they didn't arrest him. 32 minutes too late, according to the interpretation of this law. Instead, they allowed him to gather some of his belongings and walk away. The very next day, Allison was dead. Members of the house, my niece did everything she was taught to do. She called the police. She asked for help. She tried to escape. She trusted that the system designed to protect victims would protect her. But gaps in our laws and confusion about how those laws are applied allowed her abuser to walk away. If you step across the border into Wisconsin, this time frame doesn't exist. In fact, they got rid of that in 1984 because Wisconsin, decades ago, believed they recognized that domestic violence cases do not operate on a clock. Abuse does not follow a timeline, and a safety should never expire because a certain number of hours have passed. Minnesota should not have a law that creates confusion for officers and endangers victims. No family should have to stand where mine stands today. No victim should lose their life because of confusion, loopholes, or time limits in the laws here. I urge you to fix the statute so that what happened to Allison never happens to another victim again. Thank you for hearing her story.
Thank you so much, and we're so sorry for your loss. Thank you for working with us to make our laws better.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We do have one member of the public who signed up to testify, Chief Potts. You can make your way to the testifier table. You can introduce yourself again. You have 2 minutes, and you can proceed.
I think we can make this really quick. Again, Jeff Potts from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police. Just to clarify, Madam Chair, did I understand that the amendment removes subdivision 2, so that those definitions?
Chair Mueller?
Yep, that's correct.
So that was our concern. So I'll withdraw our concerns at this point, and that addresses it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Chief Potts. And we did not have anyone else from the public sign up to testify, so we will now move to member discussion of House File 3946. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question would be for you. Is the plan to lay this over?
This will be going to Judiciary.
Okay, fair enough. And so, Chair Mueller, I want to be wrong about how I'm interpreting a potential unintended consequence of the current language, so I'm going to throw out a hypothetical to you, and you can kind of walk me through what your intent or understanding of the bill's effect would be. Obviously, we want to protect people who are in dangerous situations from domestic abuse. The way I read the bill, I can envision a scenario where, say, a 17-year-old son is in a dispute with his mom, and he, let's say, mouths off to her, says something that's offensive or disrespectful to her, and out of instinct, she slaps him across the face. Technically, that's an assault. He calls the police. They show up. Now they're obligated to detain her and hold her until she has her first court date. Is that your read of the language or no?
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that hypothetical. It certainly was not a situation that I thought about, and it is a great question. And I believe we do have, I will defer to nonpartisan staff with what definition of domestic abuse household members we included, because that is a fairly broad definition.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, I think there are two responses to this that I want to share. The first is the definition is broad, and the definition of how family or household member would include family members as described. The change in Section 5, though, does not require a law enforcement officer to make an arrest. It authorizes a law enforcement officer to make an arrest. It's a may. The may is in current law. The may in current law applies to within the preceding 72 hours. With the change, the may would still be there. It would be at the discretion of the law enforcement officer, but after that 72 hours expired, they would still have that authority. The other change that's in the bill, if there was an arrest, then the person would need to be held until they see a judge as opposed to being released.
Representative Hudson?
I'm happy to be wrong. Thank you.
Excellent. We can help you with that. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one other point, too, that if you are arrested and detained before you see a judge is what we also currently have with the DWI laws.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Any other members have any comments? Chair Novotny?
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Just one comment, Chair Mueller, on the canceling of the 72-hour hold. And I would request that you maybe talk to Representative Steer, who is more in the data part and record keeping, and that from the standpoint that so often the pickup orders are issued not like a warrant, and I would like to see maybe putting a farther timeline out to give the county attorney office a chance to put out a warrant for that person so that it's a lot easier for them to find that warrant when they have contact with people. Just as an option, with that, I recommend a yes vote so we can get this to judiciary and keep working on it.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Thank you. I'm certainly willing to entertain any amendments. I will say that this is an issue with the misdemeanor domestic violence cases, right? So that's a little bit different than felony cases where the county attorney, the misdemeanors, as you know, are usually city attorney, and there's different requirements for filing warrants and complaints and that sort of thing. But I'm certainly willing to figure out a solution to what you're identifying.
Thank you, members, for the discussion. Chair Mueller renews the motion to re-refer House File 3946, as amended, to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Okay. Thank you.
All right, the next bill is House File 2976, Representative Hollins's bill. Would you like to move to re-refer House File 2976 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's my motion.
All right, and you do have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you desire?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, please.
Would you like to discuss the A1 amendment? I think it's just time.
It's dates, technical.
Right? Okay, great. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted, and please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, committee members. House File 2976 is the Minnesota Survivors Justice Act. It draws from similar laws in other states, including New York, Illinois, Georgia, and Oklahoma. and the expertise of practitioners and impacted individuals. Essentially, House File 2976 would make the survivor's status a mitigating factor in sentencing. Many public health studies have shown that victims of domestic abuse, sexual assault, and trafficking, being a victim of that can severely impair decision-making by hijacking the victim's cognitive functions through fear, trauma, and control. These abuses create a survival mode mentality, leading to short-term thinking and trauma bonding or dependency. The Survivor Justice Act creates a new statute that requires a judge to consider before sentencing for a felony offense whether the defendant was a victim of domestic abuse, sexual assault, or trafficking. If the judge determines that that defendant was a victim, that the abuse they experienced was a contributing factor in their offense, and that a lower sentence would be in the public interest, the judge can order a mitigated departure from the presumptive sentence under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. The judge could also require, as a condition of probation, that the defendant participate in treatment or programming to support them in addressing behaviors and mental health conditions arising from their experience of domestic or sexual violence. To aid the judge in making that determination, the SJA requires that the defendant's pre-sentence investigation include information about whether the defendant was a survivor and whether their survivor status was connected to their offense. The SJA also has a retroactive impact. The bill allows for currently incarcerated survivors to cite their experience of victimization in their application for pardon and other forms of retroactive relief. It does not require anybody to grant relief on those grounds. It only permits them to consider it. This is less expansive retroactive relief than other states have, but we're hopeful that it will ensure that our post-conviction system acts in line with what justice demands. Violence Free Minnesota is here to talk about the impact that this will have on survivors, and there are some letters in your packets from programs, survivors, coalitions, and experts in this field. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Nikki Engel, and I'm co-executive director of Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. Violence Free Minnesota is a coalition of over 90 member programs covering every county in our state. Our programs meet survivors of domestic and sexual abuse at some of the toughest times of their lives. I'm here today in support of the Survivors Justice Act, House File 2976. If I asked all of us in this room to name some of the many needs a victim might have or the obstacles a victim might face in leaving their abusive partner to find safety and healing, I am confident that we could name many. Lack of affordable housing and childcare, economic insecurity, loss of family and community support, threats and intimidation by the abusive partner, and so on. What's less well known and understood is that many victims are also navigating arrest, charges, and convictions of their own connected to surviving the abuse that they experienced. In the domestic violence field, we refer to these victims as criminalized survivors or survivor defendants. The letters of support you have in your packet today will show you just some of the many ways that victims are criminalized for surviving abuse. We want to name that it is especially difficult and vulnerable for criminalized survivors to come forward publicly like those did today in the packet you have, having been subject to harm at the hands of their abuser and had that harm compounded at the hands of the state. In 2022, Violence Free Minnesota polled domestic and sexual violence advocates across Minnesota and found that a whopping 89% of our advocates have worked with a victim who was facing charges of his or her own in connection to the abuse they experienced. 89%. That number is evidence that survivors find themselves at the defense table, not rarely or uncommonly, but way too often. This bill is about naming what is happening in Minnesota and across the country, that victims, primarily women and girls, are penalized for surviving violence every single day. This bill is about recognizing context and creating just outcomes for victim survivors. This bill does not overturn or prevent any guilty verdicts, but instead creates a pathway for the courts to recognize trauma and coercion and proclaim sentences in line with what justice demands. Legal systems around the country are beginning to recognize the special circumstances that criminalized survivors present to the courts and sentence them in ways that prioritize community safety and survivor dignity alongside accountability. I'll end by calling attention again to the multiple letters from survivors who shared their personal experience of being criminalized in connection to the abuse they endured. It's because of them and the many other criminalized survivors who have talked to Violence Free Minnesota and our member programs that we are bringing this bill before you today. We ask that you please support House File 2976. Thank you.
Thank you. And I don't believe you had any other testifiers signed up to testify, so we can move to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hollins, appreciate you bringing the bill forward. As I've been reading through it and listening to testimony and looking at the letters, my thinking has changed a little bit as to both where I think it came from and what you're trying to accomplish. I want to try to understand it better. Mm-hmm. So it feels like this is an attempt to keep people from who are like in a direct situation where their abuser is doing something to them and they strike back in some way or retaliate in some way, and them being criminalized for doing that. Was that an accurate characterization of the intent here?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for the question. I think that that is certainly one aspect of it, that it's the immediate part, but I also think it's important to consider how it impacts judgment while being in an abusive relationship. And I think it expands beyond certainly, I mean, you could say the immediate impact would be a self-defense in certain situations, right? And that would be a whole different aspect of things. But I think that when we're looking at this, we're trying to look at it holistically because we see that people behave in ways when they are in abusive relationships that are not typical and that don't make sense to you or I. Presumably you're not in an abusive relationship. I'm making an assumption here. But that maybe don't make sense to us and wouldn't necessarily fit into the self-defense aspect that would otherwise cover it. And I, you know, my testifier might have better examples or explanation.
No, I'm sorry. I apologize. Agreed with everything you said, Representative Hollins. And I would just add to that the Minnesota legislature has already decided that there are certain experiences of violence that are so devastating to the individuals that experience them that courts have to consider them in sentencing decisions and that there are more and that they are more effective. It's more effective to address the root causes of criminal behavior than simply penalize that. And by that, I'm referring to in 2021 when we passed the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. So if you think about the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, it is this bill would both encompass those direct experiences that you're talking about, but it's also the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, like this act, acknowledges that there are long-term impacts of experiences of violence like that that show up in PTSD, traumatic brain injury, substance use, et cetera, and that those kinds of experiences deserve to be at least considered as part of the context of someone's criminal behavior if they've been a survivor of domestic violence, sexual assault, or trafficking. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for that answer. It's helpful. So I'm trying to understand, given the language, kind of the outer limits of that principle. And in order to test that, I'm going to have to use an absurd example because that's how we find out. So I don't think of myself as a domestic abuse survivor. Never thought that way. But as I've been sitting here considering this and thinking back on some of the experiences I had when I was a child, by today's standards, certainly you could make that argument, right? We used to call it getting a whooping. Nowadays, not so much, not so tolerable in public discourse. And so because it says here in line 2-6 that the experience was a contributing factor to the offense the person committed. So if I were to go to my dad's house and pull off my belt and start whipping on him, right, would that qualify me? Would the court have to take my past childhood experience into consideration, or does there have to be like a time proximity to when the abuse occurred and the subsequent criminal behavior took place?
Representative Hollins.
So I guess thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I guess what I would say in that situation, that we don't have a clear time, temporal measure of this, but because it is a permissive language, where we're saying the judge can do this if they find that you are a victim of abuse, if it did contribute to this, and if they decide that it is in public interest to go under the sentencing guidelines. And so I think that would be a real question, right? Those are three specific factors that are within the judge's discretion under this bill to say whether or not they would consider it. As a judge, I would probably say if you're still harboring anger from when you were a child and that makes you beat on a human being, maybe not, right? Like maybe I'm like, I don't know, that seems like it's not in the public interest to allow Walter Hudson to walk around hitting people because something happened to him 30 years ago. But I think that personally, the reason why I think this is a good bill is because it is permissive and it does allow judges to take into consideration those different aspects depending on how, you know, how they see the past abuse impacting what you're doing in the present. And again, I don't know if my testifier has better.
Representative Hudson, great. Well, he's got another question. So
just a real short follow-up and then I'll let somebody else get at it. So is that discretion, does it currently not exist? Because we have downward departures all the time. Are judges not able to take into consideration that? Or is this basically just putting a flashlight on it and saying, we want you to take a look at this?
Ms. Engel.
Yes, so currently judges can look at evidence of past abuse, but from our research, from conversations with our programs, from conversations with survivors, there's nothing that says that judges must consider that. I mean, really, this is very much modeled on the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. And I can say that after that act passed, I've spoken with many prosecutors about how the Veterans Restorative Justice Act has changed their prosecutorial practices. And they've said it really has had a huge impact on their practices, that the bill and what we hope this bill will do similarly is it is forcing them to do the digging, to do that, take that effort to find out if there is a nexus to abuse or violence in this particular defendant's history, to bring that to light, right, and to take that into consideration. So prosecutors are making different decisions around charging, right, at the front end of it, not even before sentencing, right, which is really helpful. So that's the piece of it that we're saying you have to bring it to light, right? Whether or not that actually changes the sentence will be up to the judge's discretion, but it has to be brought to the table.
And I'll just chime in too, as far as the sentencing, for a judge to depart, there has to be, it's been couple of years since I practiced, but for durational departure, that's based on the actual facts of the crime itself, and I think there has to be substantial and compelling reason, nonpartisan's giving me a head nod, to depart. And then for dispositional departure, it's particular amenability to probation. So certainly that some of this might factor into particular amenability, but it really doesn't exactly fit into either of those categories currently with how judges sentence. Other questions? Vice Chair Feist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Love to hear discussions of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. Every year I go to a celebration of the act at St. Thomas, and they have people come and share their story of how they were at a low point in their life and how, because they had contact with our criminal legal system and it treated them like a human being, and it helped lift them out of that and helped them thrive in their lives. So I'm just really grateful that we are hearing this bill. I also wanted to just share a story of a friend of mine that I think this would have helped. She was a victim of trafficking, and she went down a really bad path, the crimes that she committed were not like directly self-defense, but they were absolutely connected to her victimization. And when she finally came in contact with law enforcement, she was like, I will get help. And instead she was criminalized and she ended up serving time in prison. And now she got a PhD in biology because she's a rock star. And she's doing really well and she got a pardon now. But it was just, she's shared with me her experience of being trafficked and the life she led at that point, and if the system had treated her like the victim that she was, she could have gone down a faster path to kind of getting back on track. So thank you so much for bringing this bill. Thank you.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hollins, have you spoke to the County Attorneys Association or the judiciary on this and figuring out why we're in this gap right now? And then would there be any effects to them and how they do their job because of this bill?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a fair question. I don't think I have this year, but I've been carrying the bill for a couple of years, and I've had conversations previously about it. I'm not sure if the if my testifier or anybody from their organization has had conversations this year.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I think that's kind of crucial to kind of figure out this, all the pieces of this, pie, just to make sure we're able to effectively get, a better understanding of the whole situation. But having those stakeholders come to the table might be crucial for us to understand all sides of this. So I appreciate some looking into that. But thank you.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Representative Hollins.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. I certainly will. I mean, if this goes on to judiciary, that's going to be absolutely critical when we have those conversations with the county attorneys. So I think that's going to be necessary.
And I'll just note, too, that there is not any letter of opposition in the packet, or I think they're here. I'm not going to necessarily put them on the spot. I don't know that they vetted it through their committee into the process. So. But, certainly it has been out there over the years. And I know I've made changes in past years. There were certainly versions I didn't like and have requested. Not that that counts for the County Attorneys Association, but just to point out that it's been out there for a while and changes have been made. I do have a question about other states, because I know you talked about other states that have it, including red states. And to the question that was asked, the hypothetical question that Representative Hudson asked, I'm just curious how this is playing out in some of the other states that have this. Ms. Engel?
Yeah. So we have New York, Oklahoma, and Georgia. New York has had it the longest. They passed it in 2019. And theirs is actually a bit more expansive than ours. They actually allow for folks who are in prison can apply to be resentenced under the new law. And so we don't have that. We don't have a resentencing provision in ours. And so what we know from our close conversations with the New York Coalition is it's actually too restrictive. Like, they have not seen, they know that the numbers of folks who have applied are not near the number of folks in prison who would qualify for the act. So they actually have not seen, none of the states have seen the floodgates open. Georgia has passed one. They're the most, has let one woman out of prison. Again, they've been the newest. That's just a year and a half. But again, very small numbers. I think New York is like at 80 released, and they've had it since 2019. Oklahoma, I think, is at like 5 or 6. So it's not been an overwhelming number by any means. And there's at least five states are considering very similar laws this year.
Yeah, thank you. And so the resentencing piece was something that I had issues with in the past. And so the bill now takes the approach of it gives a person opportunity for pardon or clemency to apply through some of the other processes that we have rather than going right to a court for resentencing. So appreciate your willingness to work on that over the years.
Absolutely.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Hollins, and thanks, Ms. Engel, for your work. And I agree with you, Chair, that there were prior versions of this that I, as a prosecutor, had some concerns with, and I feel like it's landed in such a good place. And just responding to some of the concerns expressed by my colleagues, just noting that the job of the judge in the pre-sentence investigation is to take a holistic look at both the offense and the person. And as I'm looking at everything listed on page 3, bottom page 2 and into page 3, things like currently the judge is directed to look, if it's a drug offense, at the adverse social economic effects the offense has had in the neighborhood, for example. So taking a broad look, it seems like we've identified a gap here where what judges are not tending to look at is something that, if you look on lines 3.26, we presumably just want judges to be aware of this. Like, has the person been a victim of one of these kinds of crimes, and is there a connection there? And then providing, Chair, as you said, that we don't currently have the ability to have a departure for these sorts of factors. It's not going to be appropriate on every case or many cases, but I think for many of us, you'd look at this and say, if the experience was a contributing factor, there may be a certain case where that is appropriate. And so I really appreciate the way this is structured. I think it makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Hollins, I think Executive Director Engel summed it up best, is pointing out just how wide of discretion that the courts currently have in the state. And we see that every day and every time a new summary of downward departures come out. I appreciate that you brought up the Veterans Bill, but the Veterans Bill was more to establish a separate court and people specifically trained in dealing with the veterans. With all the discretion that the courts have right now and with no guardrails on what the courts are doing, they've shown every day that although I believe your bill is well-intended, I don't believe that it's necessary given the current discretion that the courts already have. I think the courts overall have shown, you know, compassion for victims and situations. And with that, I recommend a no vote.
And before I turn to final comments, I'll just note that Vice Chair Feist, if you want to just clarify, just for the record, the Veterans Justice, whether or not it's just for Veterans Courts.
Yes, just to clarify, it didn't create a system that exclusively exists in Veterans Treatment Courts. It created a diversion process wherever there is that nexus between the military service and the trauma that led to the criminal act that brought them before the court. And the goal of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act was to create that option regardless of whether there was a veterans treatment court in that particular county where the offense occurred. So just wonky clarification.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Novotny, for the comments. I think when I am thinking about the Survivors Justice Act, it occurs to me that it's very hard for us to get into the heads of survivors. And I have worked at women's shelters, and I actually was counseling a survivor this weekend. And even after doing it for years, it's just hard to understand what they're going through and hard to see their perspective. They truly are thinking in a different way than we are thinking in our typical day-to-day life. And so to me, this bill is really about empathy. It's also about judicial discretion. And I have to note that this bill actually, the fiscal note says that it would save the state money. So if you care about that, $209,000 in fiscal year 27 and up to $2 million in fiscal years 28-29. So really when we're looking at this, we want these people who are survivors to come out of this situation that is terrible for them and become productive members of society. They can add to our economy instead of costing the state money. And I think that we need to be thinking broader about how we're going to do this. And so that's why I would recommend a yes vote. Thank you.
All right, Representative Hollins renews the motion to re-refer House File 3946 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3350. Chair Pinto. And I believe, Chair Pinto, your motion is to recommend that House File 3350 be placed on the general register.
That's correct.
And you do have an author's amendment, the A1. Would you like to move the A1 to get the bill in the shape you desire?
I would, Madam Chair, and members will see it's just a technical fix.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pinto, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3350 conforms state law relating to the circumstances where someone convicted of a domestic violence non-felony is prohibited from possessing a firearm to match up with the federal law regarding that. In conversation with staff and with GOP colleagues, it's to a certain extent, this is really clarifying Minnesota law even beyond conforming to federal law, because there's some some potential confusion in the way that state law is written. This again would confirm that that someone convicted of a domestic violence non-felony would be prohibited from possessing a firearm to the same extent as is true in federal law, and would hope to have some member support for the bill.
All right, and I don't see that you have testifiers, and I don't believe anybody from the public signed up to testify, so we'll move on to members' discussion. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for this. I don't usually thank authors for bringing a bill, but I think it's a good idea. I would like to see a little bit of a change. However, I don't see a judicial review or some appeal process if it's been expunged or pardoned and then it gets reversed. If it's some other thing like a discharge, there's no way to get a judicial appeal on that. So I'd like to, I think this is going to the judiciary from here, correct?
Madam Chair, the General Register, Representative Bliss. I guess I'm trying to think through, I mean, currently, if somebody has a conviction that causes them to be prohibited from possessing our Minnesota law, I'm trying to think about the circumstances. You were saying a pardon. Is that what you're referencing?
I've been reading laws, and I'm not a lawyer, so I got my brain burned today. But the way I read it, there's no, unless it's been a pardon or expunged, for somebody to petition to get their rights back. And there's other ways, a criminal conviction can be discharged, under certain circumstances. Like you go through counseling or pay a fine or something like that. There's just no way to appeal through to get your rights back is what I'm getting at.
So, Chair Pinto, can we defer to nonpartisan Mr. Johnson? Oh, Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and Representative Bliss, this is federal law, and so the state's already incorporated this into their statute. And they have a process where it only refers to expungement and pardons. And so the federal law imposes a lifetime firearms ban for these qualified domestic violence offenses. And we already have that in our books. This is just making sure our other statutes track that and don't give misinformation about the length of that firearms disability. So our hands are tied without by the federal law, because it is a lifetime ban, and that standard is there for having your rights restored or having the lifetime ban removed.
Representative Bliss.
Okay, so under 609.165, the restoration of civil rights, I need my eyeballs. And again, pardon me, my brain's fried today. Person's been deprived of civil rights by reason of conviction of a crime and is therefore discharged, such discharge shall restore the person to all civil rights and full citizenships. That's if it's discharged. The other one, ineligible persons, I didn't highlight this one. It has to be expunged or pardoned to get it back. And there is a 672.713. Restoration of firearms and ammunition eligibility, that's for civilly committed person. But you may seek relief through a court. And maybe I'm not explaining this right. Just a lot of confused faces.
Chair Liebling told me my face looked confused in committee today, too. So I guess that's my resting face. Wondering if the question is, those provisions that allow for restoration or discharge in state law aren't recognized federally? Is that the issue? I could be just totally confused as well. Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and Representative Bliss, yeah, essentially correct. So the federal law has their own standard. It's very clear as to what the path is to have this specific firearms disability removed. And the goal of this bill was to incorporate that exact standard so that there was no confusion about both citizens and practitioners as to what the pathway was to have the disability removed.
Representative Bliss.
Well, I was told last week I had a resting, some other type of resting face, so I think confused is better than what I had. I guess I'm just confused. I thought that there was a way that you could petition through the state court to get your civil rights restored. And you're telling me that the federal law doesn't have that option. So we're actually removing something that's already there?
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, Representative Bliss, no, the federal law wouldn't recognize the state's restoration of that person's rights. So the person could certainly pursue that path, but they would still be under federal law prohibited from possessing this unless they follow the pathway prescribed by the federal statute. So the state court cannot give them relief from this disability under federal law.
Oh, okay.
Representative Bliss.
One more real quick. So this law is not just copying federal, codifying the federal. It's actually making it more prohibitive. Is that correct?
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, Representative Bliss. No, it's we've already cross-referenced the specific, it's called the Lautenberg Amendment.
Okay.
It was passed in 1996, and it imposes a lifetime firearms ban on certain domestic violence, misdemeanor domestic violence convictions. In 2014, the state referenced those statute, the Lautenberg Amendment statute, in our ineligible person statute. So it's been on the books for 11 years. And so anyone who had these qualified domestic violence offenses would not be permitted to have firearms unless they were expunged or pardoned under existing law. Current in our statutes now, we did not update our statutes, which suggested that persons could have firearms disability for these offenses based on whatever length the court imposes. That was not at the discretion of the court, because under federal law, they should not have firearms for the rest of their life unless they're restored by the standards set forth in the federal statute, which is incorporated into our statute for the last 11 years.
Representative Bliss.
We don't pay these guys enough.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I agree with that. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. I'm just trying to get at the crux of what this bill would do if passed, and I am on board with it from an initial look, but this is a question potentially for nonpartisan again. So under United States Code Title 18, Section 921, it lists off what qualifies as a form of domestic assault that would then trigger this ban. And in Section 921C, it says that in the case of a person who has not more than one conviction of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence against an individual in a relationship and is not otherwise prohibited in this chapter, the person shall not be disqualified from shipping, transport, possession, receipt, or purchase of a firearm. So is this then extending beyond that current code for a singular case?
Representative Pinto.
Well, I'm hoping Mr. Diebel could assist
Mr.
me again
Diebel.
On that. Yeah.
Madam Chair and members, this firearms disability does not require multiple convictions. It's the first time conviction, and that's always been the case since 1996 under federal law and as incorporated in state law in 2014. So it is not changing the standard that's been on the books nationwide for 20 years and statewide for 11 or 12.
Oh, you're good. Okay. Any further questions? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. So, Mr. Diebel, what happens to someone that falls between the crack? Under the current law, if someone was convicted of a domestic assault and they had got that expungement, or they get their rights restored, but so they come into a conflict and the federal courts find out that matter what, as you said earlier, the federal court's not going to recognize the state court's expungement or release. So what happens to that person if they go through all the processes and then still come into a federal court for charging?
Mr. Tebow?
Madam Chair, Chair Novotny. So let me just clarify. If the state expunges the offense, the state offense, or pardons it, then that would meet the federal standard for removing it. It's these other paths that Representative Bliss was referring to about restoration of civil rights. That statute is not the same standard as the pardon or expungement. So if a state court expunges a state offense, then the federal court or federal law would recognize it as expunged because it's appropriate that the state court would expunge it because they're the only one with the authority to do so.
Chair Novotny.
Big subject, and for disclosure, we did spend quite a bit of time last Friday talking through every line of this bill, and it's still confusing, but I guess my final takeaway from this is that, you know, compliance with the federal courts and federal rules is important.
Thank you. Representative Pinto, any closing comments?
Well, just I'll thank Chair Novotny for taking that time with Mr. Debo and me. And maybe I'm realizing that the bill summary, that final paragraph, feels like it's about the best description of exactly what we're doing here and why it makes a lot of sense. So if anybody continues to be confused, just hang on to that paragraph because I think it'll make it clear. And with that, I very much appreciate the discussion. And, yes, particular thanks to our amazing House research team.
Yes, thank I'll you. Echo that to our House research team. Representative Pinto renews the motion to recommend that House File 3350 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And members really appreciate the discussion today, and we are actually going to end early. So thank you so much. This meeting is adjourned.